Spiked is free, and it always will be. There's no paywall, no subscriptions. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to do that, we need your help. If you support the work that we do here, why not become a regular donor? Just £5 per month will keep us going, even in these uncertain times. To do so, just go to spiked-online.com and click on the big red donate button. Whatever you can give is greatly appreciated, especially given all that's going on in the world. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. I'm Tom Slater, and this is the show where myself and Chris Snowden discuss the latest news in the liberalism, censorship, and the nanny state with the help of an invited guest. In this episode, we're joined by Constantine Kissin to discuss the woke cultural revolution, Britain's long road out of lockdown, and the rise of big tech censorship. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater and today I'm joined as ever by Chris Snowden. Hello Chris, how are you doing?
Hi Tom, not too bad, thanks.
Good to hear. And we're delighted to be joined today by Constantine Kissin. Constantine is a stand-up comedian. He's also the co-host of Trigonometry, which is a great YouTube show and podcast known to many of our listeners, I'm sure. So Constantine, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me. You introduced me as a stand-up comedian. I think that was the case in the past. I haven't been on stage for so many months. I'm not sure I'm still am a stand-up comedian, but it's good to be with you.
Excellent. So, so much has happened since we last did one of these podcasts. Not much of it good, I think it's fair to say. But let's kick off by talking about the woke cultural revolution, as it were. So the remarkable speed with which the protests around the killing of George Floyd in the US quickly became, particularly in the UK, about smashing statues, memory-holding sitcoms, you know, demanding apologies from everyone from Anton Deck to David Walliams for their alleged complicity in racism over the years. The speed with which this discussion originally about police brutality has just become overrun with identity politics, basically. You know, this demand that we see racism everywhere and that everyone kind of toe this identitarian line. I think, Constantine, sort of on one level, a lot of this is quite ridiculous. You know, day after day, there's just another very strange, very mad story about someone or something being cancelled. But how concerned do you think we should be about all of this?
Well, this is the ultimate end goal of the cultural revolution that's been slowly creeping up on us for 60 years. And I think what scares me a lot about it is that the people who are behind it are now very emboldened. They feel like they're succeeding and they're going to push the pedal to the metal. And as I've been predicting, and I'm sure you guys are not oblivious to this either, you know, when that happens, it provokes a reaction from the other side. And that's my real concern. I'm less concerned about these woke people running around canceling stuff. Yes, I think, you know, tearing down statues, etc., is not the way that you should do these things. But my big concern is the reaction that that provokes. Because, you know, when you see, you know, the Edward Colston thing, you know, should that statue have been up? I'm less kind of absolutist about that. But the way that that was torn down, I didn't agree with. But the moment you start seeing people, you know, scrawling the word racist on Winston Churchill's statue, the moment you see, you know, the British flag being burnt on a cenotaph, those are very important cultural symbols to our country and to us as a people. And when you see those being under attack, I think it makes it clear that what's happening is not so much about protesting against inequality or racial injustice or police brutality, which there are some legitimate issues to be discussed in that area. You know, what it is, it's an attack on our culture and it's an attempt to erase certain parts of our culture and to say that everything about British culture, Western culture, American culture is bad, evil and wrong and must be now torn down. And as you said, thrown down the memory hole. And what worries me is a lot of people will be quite rightly upset about that. And then potentially you start to see a conflict between the two different sides. And that has been my big fear for some time. And I unfortunately feel that that is what's happening.
Chris, what have you made of these past mad few weeks?
I think they're first and foremost a symptom of the lockdown. You know, I don't think you can close the pubs and schools and have no festivals, have no football, any sports on, keep people in the homes during an unusually hot spring. And have everybody, you know, in an extreme state of kind of hypochondria and fear. without something like this happening. It didn't have to be this, obviously. And obviously, Constantine is absolutely right that this has been bubbling away under the surface, mainly at universities, for a very, very long time, but particularly over the last kind of 6 or 7 years. So it didn't have to be this, but it was this. And with hindsight, it kind of makes sense that it would be this. They kind of get you, you know, to paint yourself in a corner, because the things that they're protesting about in very broad terms are so uncontroversial, right? No one, or hardly anyone, is in favor of racism, let alone slavery or police brutality. And clearly the case of George Floyd was shocking and appalling. But it didn't happen in this country, first and foremost, right? I mean, about 1,000 people get killed by cops in America every year. If you think about 50 are unarmed. My understanding is actually there isn't much of a racial difference between them, but I'm not that familiar with the figures, so I don't want to hold forth too much on that. What I do know in this country is it's very rare for police to kill anybody. I had a look. There's a Wikipedia page of every single person who's ever been killed by a policeman in this country, and it doesn't take you very long at all to read all about everyone who's been killed by a policeman in the last 20 years. And the vast majority of them involve people pulling a gun or a knife on a policeman. There's a very small number of kind of controversial or unresolved cases, and some of them are white and some of them are black. It's just untrue to say that we have systematic brutality against black people, or indeed anyone else in this country, where we have unarmed police officers. So yeah, it was weird and troubling to see the protests spill over very quickly into violence, to see police running away from protesters in the middle of our capital city, and to see war memorials desecrated, including even the statue of Abraham Lincoln. You know, these people are so profoundly ignorant that they would put graffiti on Lincoln's statue. So I see it really as a period of extreme madness and a very mad period of time. I don't think it would have happened had a lockdown been in place, but probably it would have happened sooner or later.
Constantine, I guess I was interested to get your thoughts on a lot of the arguments that are being made by the kind of extremes of the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, the idea that kind of racism stains almost everything, that we do need this kind of cultural cleansing. That's a position that's, you know, it's a minority position. It's held by quite a small amount of people, I think it's fair to say. But at the same time, there seems to have been a massive capitulation to it. You know, everyone from the Premier League, big corporations, even government have had to tiptoe around this issue a little bit. Why do you think there's been such a willingness to, I guess, just absorb this kind of ideology on the part of people who might have previously thought it was a little bit too extreme even for them, you know, because it just feels like everyone now has to bend the knee, as it were, before this kind of new set of ideas?
Well, I think the idea that this is an extreme ideology is only something that people like us who listen to podcasts like this would know. If you speak to ordinary people who aren't in the political game, if you like, in any way, what they hear from Black Lives Matter is Black Lives Matter. And as Chris said, no one disagrees with that, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody agrees that police brutality is bad. I would just pick up on the point that Chris made that very few people have died. And this is absolutely right. Very, very few people have been killed in this country. I think last year was 2 people who were unarmed at the time that they were shot by the police who were killed. One of whom was Usman Khan, the London Bridge terrorist. On the other hand, that's not the same as police brutality. You know, I speak to a lot of black comedians, for example, and they'll tell you that they've been stopped on the street and questioned by the police many, many times. You know, the first time being when they were like 13. So I certainly feel like there is an issue there that some people feel like the police target people from certain communities. And maybe that's something we do need to look at. I don't know. But in terms of your broader point about Black Lives Matter, I do think that the vast majority of the public have absolutely no idea who or what Black Lives Matter is or stands for. I think what they fundamentally hear is Black Lives Matter means Black Lives Matter. They don't know about Black Lives Matter wishing to abolish capitalism. They don't know about Black Lives Matter wishing to undermine the nuclear family. They don't know about Black Lives Matter wanting to abolish the police. And I've had this argument with people so many times now online where they'll say, well, where are you getting this information from when you make this statement? And I'll send them the link and I'll give them the quote and they just don't reply. And I think part of that is people are simply much more comfortable not ingesting information that then means they have to have the wrong opinion afterwards. And I think a lot of it is to do with that. It's like the marketing of Black Lives Matter, the BLM movement, is very good. You know, it's very, very powerful. And the meme is that if you don't agree with BLM, then you're racist and evil. Well, most people don't want to be racist and evil in public, you know, let alone in private, right? So I think a lot of it is about how the perception of it has been managed. And most people have absolutely no idea. And frankly, you know, like, look at Black Lives Matter, founded by three Marxists, self-described Marxists, who talk about how they've been trained in it. Now, most people don't know what that means, right? Most people don't know what that means, and they don't know what, where that ideology comes from, what it means for our society, how it links to the emergence of identity politics. And they just listen to the slogan, and that's what they go with.
It's about the marketing of it. With the pulling down the statues and with the focus on slavery and racism in general, everyone's agreed that slavery is a bad thing, but they've managed to spin it in such a way that if you're against mobs pulling down statues, then somehow you're in favor of slavery. If you're against the Premiership having Black Lives Matter on their shirts for weeks and weeks on end, then you must think Black Lives don't matter. If you're against the bending of the knee, you must be in favor of racism. And obviously, there are much deeper questions with this. I mean, take the Premiership thing, for example. I mean, I think there are a lot of good reasons why they shouldn't be having Black Lives Matter on their shirts. One of them, very pragmatic from my point of view, is I actually watch football. I quite like to know who the players are. I'm playing fantasy football. I want to know who to bring in and take out. Second thing is, as I understand it, there's always been a rule that Premier League players don't promote any politics on the pitch, on the shirts or anywhere else. I think the only kind of mild exception to that is Remembrance Day poppies, if you consider that a political cause. Thirdly, we've already got Kick Racism Out of Football, which is a perfectly good, effective, long-standing football-based movement against racism, which has worked pretty well insofar as you can measure these things. But fourthly, and most importantly, is that unlike Kick Racism Out of Football, it's not accountable, Black Lives Matter, in any way to the Premiership. And anything could happen in the next few weeks with Black Lives Matter protests. And Black Lives Matter, as an organization, doesn't have any control over people doing things in its name. So the Premiership ultimately could be tarnished with God knows what over the next few weeks if we start seeing riots and other kinds of madness in the names of Black Lives Matter, and it's going to be on the shirts. I think it's a really bad decision, but like a lot of kind of corporate organizations in the last few weeks, they've just gone out of their way to go along with what they see as a tide of public opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's worth making the distinction that, as you've both pointed out, that in a way, Black Lives Matter is a slogan as much as it is an organization. You know, it's not a membership organization. Most of the people on these demonstrations haven't, you know, aren't card-carrying members of it. But as you say, it does have a specific set of politics. I'd probably push back on the idea that it's kind of Marxist, as far as I think there's the kind of identity politics of it, I think, in some respects, pushes aside a lot of the kind of class issues, etc., that Marxists might previously been interested in. But it is fascinating. And I think it just feels like it's wrapped itself around a general mood or a general set of ideas which kind of already existed. And the nastiness of it, I think, has been quite striking. I wanted to bring up the Munira Mirza case with you, Constantine, because I know someone who you'd interviewed has obviously contributed many times to Spikes over the years. She's the head of the Number 10 Policy Unit. She was appointed to help set up this new racial equality commission that the government is working on. And purely because she disagrees with the kind of current anti-racist ideology, ideas around systemic racism, has claimed that that approach fosters a level of grievance politics, was met with this pretty incredible backlash, which in many respects was pretty racist, you know, basically calling her an Uncle Tom in kind of various different euphemistic forms. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, Constantine, particularly because you've actually, you know, sat down to her and actually heard what this alleged monster has to say for herself.
Well, let me push back on your pushing back about the Marxism point first, which is simply to say that when I was talking about this kind of neo-Marxist ideology, which has replaced class with identity. But in terms of Munira, we had her on Trigonometry probably a year and a half ago. And I would have to say to you that if you were to design a person from scratch who you would want to be running a major body within government, which is based around policy and decision-making that involves controversial issues where you really have to be very careful, you have to be nuanced, you have to appreciate the data, you have to have a breadth of understanding, you have to understand that it's not just one thing that causes an outcome, but it's a multitude of variables that affect it. If you were to design a person from scratch, Munira Mirza would be who you would create, right? She is a thoroughly decent, sensible, kind, fact-based, well-intentioned person who really is probably of all the amazing guests that we've had on the show over the last two and whatever years, she's probably one of the most impressive people that we've ever met, genuinely. And I say that irrespective of whether she is conservative or not conservative or whatever. I'm just talking about her as a person and her grasp and grip of the huge issues that she was talking to us about, you know, all this institutional racism, why are there disparities between different ethnic groups in education and crime statistics and prison populations, all of that stuff. And the way that she was treated, I think it shows you something that Lawrence Fox said on Trigonometry about a week ago, which is race is no longer about skin color, it's about opinion. Your race is determined by your opinion. So Munira Mirza is not allowed to be Asian anymore because she has the wrong opinion. She questions the idea of that institutional racism exists in the way that it's described. And that means that she's no longer brown. She's coconut, Oreo, race traitor, Uncle Tom, whatever slogan. And people are very comfortable now to use these sort of terms in public on Twitter. They fear no bans. They don't fear being kicked off of Twitter for being racist. They don't fear being called out on it because they won't be. And this double standard, I think, is highlighting the fact that this ideology of treating different ethnic groups as kind of monoliths is fundamentally racist. And there's no way of getting away from that. And they insist on their right to be racist. They are the new racist.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So at this point, let's move on and discuss the latest news in COVID and lockdown. But I guess first, almost leading on from the discussion we've just been having, it would be good to talk a little bit about the double standards that have been brought to the fore in relation to the protests in particular. You know, you had a very kind of pro-lockdown media and political set who had spent weeks, you know, criticising people for going to the beach or having a VE Day street party, who were suddenly celebrating, making excuses for, if not actively participating in some of these BLM protests. And actually in the US, there was this story where over 1,000 health professionals that had actually written a letter saying why BLM protests shouldn't be shut down, where previously they'd been quite critical of some of the anti-lockdown protests. So Chris, I know this was a story that particularly struck you. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about it?
Yes, I'd love to. It's amazing. I mean, you're probably familiar with quite a lot of politicians who, let's not forget, did criminalize protests at the end of March, you know, and the legislation has changed a bit along the way, but it's always been illegal. I was to leave your house without a reasonable excuse, which makes a protest obviously illegal, because protests, of course, were not considered a reasonable excuse. And the current situation is that you can't go out and gather in a group of more than six people. So it's always been illegal. So politicians who said the Black Lives Matter protest good and people should, you know, be applauded for doing it are hypocrites, and they're hypocrites for a few days later reinforcing that legislation. But the public health lobby are even more hypocritical because they are the public health lobby, and this is the biggest public health crisis in probably 100 years. And this letter signed by 1,288 public health professionals in America, I don't know if you've read it, I'll read some of it out. I mean, all you can do really is just read it out. It's unbelievable. So this is an open letter in which they start by talking about a protest in Michigan, which was against the lockdown. And they say, infectious disease physicians and public health officials publicly condemned these actions and privately mourned the widening rift between leaders in science and a subset of the communities that they serve. They then go on to talk about the George Floyd protests and say, a public health response to these demonstrations is also warranted. But this message must be wholly different from the response to white protesters resisting stay-at-home orders. They then go on to say that white supremacy is a lethal public health issue. Black people are more likely to develop COVID-19. Black people with COVID-19 are diagnosed later in the disease course and have a higher rate of hospitalization, mechanical ventilation, and death. COVID-19 among black patients is yet another lethal manifestation of white supremacy. Well, you might think that is a good reason to discourage a lot of black people from meeting up during the middle of a pandemic, but not a bit of it as far as they're concerned. They say that staying at home, social distancing, and public masking are effective at minimizing the spread of COVID-19. However, as public health advocates, we do not condemn these gatherings as risky for COVID-19 transmission. We support them as vital to the national public health. And then, just to reinforce the point, they say this should not be confused with a permissive stance on all gatherings, particularly protests against stay-home orders. Those actions not only oppose public health interventions, but are also rooted in white nationalism and run contrary to respect for black lives. They demand that laws respect infection prevention recommendations by maintaining distance from protesters and wearing masks, And then they say at the end, the authorities should prepare for an increased number of infections in the days following a protest. So Black Lives Matter, but not enough to, you know, discourage Black people. The clear assumption is that it's going to cause some kind of second wave. I don't know if that's actually happened. I think, fortunately, it doesn't seem to have happened in London, which is very encouraging. And finally, just to read you the last line, we express solidarity and gratitude towards demonstrators who have already taken on enormous personal risk to advocate for their own health, the health of their communities, and the public health of the United States. Now, listen, if you believe in something like the Black Lives Matter people do, and indeed like the anti-lockdown people do, I think it's perfectly reasonable to say we think this cause is more important than the threat from coronavirus. And clearly that's what a lot of the protesters in the George Floyd protests come riots believe. That's perfectly reasonable for them to say that. It's not reasonable for public health people to say that. You know, their priority obviously should be the protection of public health. It clearly was when people were protesting in favor of Donald Trump or against the lockdown. But I've been saying for years that public health is basically a political movement. It's much more interested in other issues, political issues, including what they describe here as white supremacy, than it is in protecting public health. And this, I think, is just cast iron proof.
Constantine, what do you make of these double standards, not necessarily just in relation to the public health stuff, but more broadly, because it seems like there's been a lot of them recently?
Well, to be honest with you guys, I've given up expecting this kind of woke side of things to have standards. I genuinely have. I don't think that we're going to get there because they don't operate on facts or reason or logic. They operate on emotion. So if you feel strongly enough about something today, and then tomorrow you feel strongly enough that what you felt yesterday was exactly the opposite of what you should do today, then you'll do one thing yesterday and you'll do another thing tomorrow. And you won't cross their mind that there's a hypocrisy or an inconsistency. I mean, even Piers Morgan was a very good example of this. He banged on about Dominic Cummings for a week and it was covered in this country like it was a terrorist attack. And I'm not even exaggerating. It literally was front page of the BBC, massive section of the website, bigger than any other story, in a way that they genuinely literally normally cover terrorist attacks. And they went from that for a week, bombarding us with, you know, Dominic Cummings, the biggest story in history, to the very next week, Piers Morgan saying, I'm so proud of my son on going outside to these Black Lives Matter protests. And he did his best to social distance. It was very difficult. And I just retweeted it saying, I'm so proud of my son, Dominic, for driving up to Durham to be with his family. He tried to socially distance and respect the rules, but it was very difficult. And people, they just continue as if nothing happened. So I genuinely have given up expecting any sort of, I don't think calling out their hypocrisy works because I don't think they mind being hypocrites.
And Chris, just to get a little bit more kind of COVID and lockdown news in here. So whilst, you know, our freedom to protest is still curtailed, or at least curtailed under certain circumstances, we have had some of our liberty is being gifted back to us slowly. There's been an announcement this week about pubs reopening early July under certain conditions, household bubbles expanding. It seems like a lot of the rules are going to go from being around social distancing are going to go from being kind of matters of law to matters of guidance. Are you heartened by all of this?
Yes, not a moment too soon, but it's good that I will be able to play snooker again, presumably, and go to the pub. And I think it will cheer up the nation immensely. I dare say the weather will turn on July the 4th. It'll start chucking down rain for the next 2 months. But I'm pretty cheerful about it. Obviously, I hope it doesn't lead to a second wave. I hope people are sensible. You know, I don't actually understand why they're doing it on a Saturday, I have to say. I don't want to be too grudging about this, but it seems to me it's going to take people a while to get used to the new normal, and everyone's going to be desperate to go down the pub. Whatever day they open the pubs, they're going to be busy. But doing it on a Saturday, really? Yeah, I would have done it on a Monday myself, but we shall see how it goes. Given the public opinion is still behind on this, it's still kind of, you know, against the government and still on the kind of the Piers Morgan side, I imagine there'll be lots of tabloid splashes about drunken people in the streets of Newcastle and Cardiff and so on, just like you get every New Year's Eve. We should just keep our fingers crossed it doesn't lead to a second wave. You have to remember, it didn't lead to a second wave when Cummings went to Barnard Castle. It didn't lead to a second wave when the BLM protests were on, touch wood. It didn't lead to a second wave when the schools were partially reopened. None of this happened yet. We've had little glimpses of second waves most recently in Germany, but they seem, touch wood, to have been kept under control. But either way, we couldn't go on like we were. You know, I think we went on far too long. I remember looking at the graph. Do you remember the Neil Ferguson graph back in March? I remember looking at that thinking there is no way it's going to last that long, right? It was just like a huge curve, and it was a 3-month period from end of March to the beginning of July, funnily enough. And I thought, well, there's no way the government's going to introduce social distancing for that long. And of course, in the end, they did much more than introduce social distancing, and they did it for longer than that. So I'm pretty pessimistic about the state of the economy. I'm a bit less pessimistic now that the 2 meter rule has gone, and particularly now that the new rules are basically guidance rather than legislation. I still think we're in for a massive economic depression, to be honest, and millions and millions of people, probably about 5 million has always been my estimate, out of work. And that is not going to help, you know, the issues we've just been talking about. You know, schools and universities are still closed for a long time. There'll be a lot of young people out of work, being pretty frustrated. So we're in for a really, really bad time, but at least now we can drown our sorrows.
What about you, Constantine? What are your thoughts as we're kind of slowly edging out of lockdown?
Well, it makes me question the whole lockdown in the first place, which I initially supported because, you know, I am not a doctor or a medical expert. So when that information was given to us, I was like, well, if this is the evidence or the scientific whatever, then this is what we got to do. But as Chris says, you know, the fact that we've continued to open stuff up and now we had massive protests in the street and that doesn't seem to have caused a resurgence of this infection, it makes me question the whole lockdown. And equally, I wonder whether the reason for that is that these people were outside and in the sun, which apparently kills the virus pretty efficiently. So that makes me wonder whether we're going to have a second wave simply because we were always going to have one when the good weather ends in October and November. And that would be my worry because obviously, again, as Chris says, the economic situation is such that we're not going to be able to take the measures we've just taken again. And that's just not going to happen. And so where are we left then? And as I said, I think it makes me certainly very, very suspicious as to our rationale for the lockdown, whether lockdown made that much of a difference, frankly, whether this would all have been the same if we hadn't had one.
Yeah, and you have to remember, you know, going back to that Neil Ferguson graph, there's a initial bell curve lasting 3 months, but then there's a second one, you know, and people seem to have completely forgotten about all that now, maybe because everyone's just sick of Sage and Neil Ferguson, these people don't trust him. But you know, the view was, not unreasonably, that the reason you want to squash the sombrero but do allow it to spread a bit is because you don't want to have a massive second wave in the winter when you've also got flu and you've got much colder weather. And people just seem to put that out of their mind now completely. And it seems that we're going to be probably opening the schools and universities just as the second wave is coming. So all we can do is keep our fingers crossed and hope that Sage were wrong and that maybe it just goes away or maybe people have some kind of immunity, but it's not obvious that will happen. And the outbreaks in South America do seem to suggest that this is more of a winter thing, certainly than a summer thing, probably even more than a spring thing.
Chris, what do you think will happen in terms of the government reaction if there is a second wave in the winter? What are they going to do?
I think it's possible that they'll do exactly the same thing as they did before, which is to kind of acknowledge what you just said, which we cannot go into lockdown. We cannot afford to go into lockdown again. Therefore, we'll try and be more Swedish about it, at which point maybe they'll succeed, as in my opinion, the Swedes have, insofar as their health system hasn't collapsed, or it will get out of control again and they'll be forced to go into lockdown. And that would be just pandemonium on every level. And obviously it would be extremely bad for people's view of the government. I think that's a worst case scenario, but I don't think it's particularly unlikely.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. So on that potentially quite bleak note, let's talk about our final topic of today, and that's big tech censorship, something we've talked about on the show before. So this past week, Twitter has announced that the far-right provocateur Katie Hopkins has been given a permanent ban for breaking the hateful conduct policy, although they provided not really much evidence as to what she'd done. But anyway, it was a move that felt quite kind of inevitable at this point and was also another kind of blow to online freedom. We've seen many of which recently. There's been a kind of concerning thing recently where a lot of online censorship, it feels like, has been almost emboldened by the pandemic as well, which is something we might talk about. So companies like YouTube, you know, continuing to pull down videos if they go against WHO guidelines. Just feels like the power of social media at the moment, both both as kind of like moral but also like scientific arbiters has been pretty empowered. Constantine, I know you and trigonometry have had some brushes with YouTube in the past, which I do want to get into. But before we go into that, I just wanted to get your thoughts on the Katie Hopkins ban in particular, because for those of us who believe in free speech, you know, it's often quite a tricky sell to defend people like Hopkins. But what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I've defended her many times, even though she completely randomly called me a soy boy last time I was on TV. So my desire for her to be on Twitter isn't great, but I also don't think she should be banned. So I always defend people as long as they're not inciting violence or hatred against people. That's where I draw the line. And I don't like Katie Hopkins. I think the stuff that she posts is gratuitous, provocative, unnecessarily. I don't think she has much of value to add. She's quite entertaining in a very kind of stupid and unpleasant way, but she's very entertaining. So I don't think people should be getting banned off Twitter for saying things. Equally, I mean, I have to say, and this is one of the things that troubles me probably more even than that, is whenever we now see reporting, have you guys noticed this? Whenever we see reporting about somebody being banned from a platform or somebody being taken down from YouTube or whatever, we never actually get told what it was that caused them to be banned. We never get told the quote or the tweet or the clip or whatever. We just get told that this person, and in fact, I think in her case, they specifically said that there was no one incident. It was just an accumulation of things. Well, that's not how it works. Either you say something that's against the rules or you say something that's in the rules. You don't get to accumulate this stuff. So and that's the thing that troubles me the most, which is essentially any person could be blocked or banned without anyone else being able to check for themselves whether they personally think that's a violation of the rules or whether that's the right thing.
That was interesting as well, because I think the Daily Mirror had a poke around in the last few tweets that Katie Hopkins sent, and it seemed to be mainly her having a pop at Marcus Rashford, so there wasn't necessarily anything quite direct there. It was very strange.
Well, that could have done it. That'd be enough these days, I reckon.
Yeah, he is a saint now, so that's important to take. But Chris, what's your take on this? I know, obviously, a lot of libertarians, it's Twitter, it's its own company, it can make its own decisions, but is this still not an alarming thing that, you know, people are getting booted off these platforms left, right and centre?
Yeah, it is. I'm torn about this issue for exactly that reason. It is a private company, their rules. And it started out Twitter being pretty vehemently pro-free speech, and it forced off a lot of people who wanted various people banned. And then the last two or three years, starting with Milo, I guess, and then Tommy Robinson and David. Is David Icke still on there? Maybe it's just YouTube. I get all these companies mixed up. But they'll ban them all eventually. And I really don't like Katie Hopkins. I think she's, you know, proper racist. I didn't follow her, but I didn't mind her being on Twitter. I don't think she should have been kicked off. As far as I can tell, she hadn't broken the terms of service. And I don't think they should have kicked off Robinson and Milo and most people, Alex Jones or whatever. You know, I don't mind these people being on there. It's a difficult one, you know, when you have companies with an effective monopoly. I know there is a new kind of rival to Twitter getting going, and maybe that will succeed for people who are interested in free speech, but it's very difficult for people to leave a platform like that when they've already got an audience. So I really don't know what the answer is. I find it quite worrying, and I certainly find it particularly worrying, I must say, when trigonometry gets taken off for no reason at all that I can see. That's YouTube. Well, yeah, do you actually get banned, or is it just shadow banned? Constantine.
Well, this is the thing, is that we've had one video in the past, some time ago, actually deleted and described as hate speech because the person.
Which one was that?
That was the interview with Posy Parker, the gender critical ex-feminist who said that trans women aren't women. And this was hate speech, which according to YouTube incites violence against a minority group. And that's obviously a farce. Eventually, due to a public backlash against that, that video was reinstated. But more recently, Tom, coming to the point you made earlier, we interviewed Peter Hitchens, with whom Chris has sparred on the drugs issue many, many times. But on this occasion, we were talking about the lockdown and the government's response to COVID-19. And that video was not banned. And it was shadow banned instead. And what that means for people who are not familiar with the language is essentially it was not being shown to people while it was publicly on YouTube. So if you went to our channel, you could find it, but you could not find it by searching for it. It would never be suggested to you, even if you specifically searched for Peter Hitchens coronavirus or Peter Hitchens COVID-19. So it's a way of artificially hiding something that should be available for public consumption. And I actually think it's much worse than banning something, because if you ban a video, at least we then know that it's been banned. we can make an appeal, we can kick up a fuss, we can complain to YouTube, we can contact them through private channels, we can actually do something. But when this kind of stuff happens through this covert means, quite often you don't know that it's happening. And this is actually, I think, a sign of something much, much worse and potentially much more dangerous, which is YouTube shaping our conversations, YouTube shaping our perceptions of reality, YouTube shaping, and Google, because they're the same company, shaping what we believe to be true about the world. The way I think about it is, if Galileo came along now, he'd probably be shadow banned by YouTube, you know, if we were in that environment. So this idea that, you know, banning things is bad, but shadow banning is kind of okay. No, it's much worse. It's hiding the fact that something is being banned. And it's far more dangerous, given that, as Chris says, these companies are monopolies. They're absolutely monopolies. There's no question about it, that Google is the number one search engine in the world. YouTube is the second most used search engine in the world, right? These companies have a complete monopoly on our information. They control everything. And so, you know, much as I'm uncomfortable, and frankly, I don't know what the right answer is. In terms of, do you regulate them? Do you break them up? What do you do? I'm very uncomfortable with that side of things. But the idea that they're just a private company and they need to be left to their own devices, that's not going to be sustainable over this period of time. It's just not.
And I think that point you make about them kind of edging into the point of kind of pronouncing on truth has been really alarming in relation to a lot of the coronavirus stuff. Because whilst there's been a lot of social media censorship in recent years, there are always lines they weren't particularly willing to cross. So Facebook in particular caught a lot of flack because they said they weren't, you know, in previous times going to take down conspiracy theories or Holocaust denial or things like this, because they said, you're effectively inviting us beyond, you know, taking down hate speech, etc., however defined, to pronounce on what is and isn't true. And even up until the first couple of weeks of the pandemic, they were saying that they weren't going to do that. But then, you know, sure enough, as night follows day, David Icke and other people like that are booted off. It has really become more and more expanded. But Chris, was there something you want to come in with?
Yeah, I mean, it's like John Stuart Mill said all those years ago, you know, one of the main things in favor of free speech is that the person might be right. You know, the person might have a point. However unlikely it might seem, you know, possibly trans women aren't women. Possibly face masks actually do work. You know, these are not unthinkable propositions. And the WHO is a great example of this. You know, so halfway through the pandemic, Twitter and maybe some of the other big tech companies said, we're going to start censoring people who are putting out dangerous messages about COVID-19. And at one level, you've got people selling quack cures for it. But on another level, you've just got people saying, I think face masks probably work, which was the opposite of what the World Health Organization and most organizations like Public Health England were saying at the time. Well, it turns out those people were right, and Twitter would have censored them for speaking the truth. This is why we need to hear from people, because they might well be right.
I mean, even at one point, you know, saying that there was human-to-human transmission of COVID-19 was going against the World Health Organization.
Right, yeah. I mean, who's put out more misinformation, really, when you look back, than the World Health Organization? But I don't think Dr. Tedros should have been kicked off Twitter for being, you know, consistently wrong for weeks on end. It's really, really dangerous, and it really illustrates the importance of allowing people to say things. And you've always got hard cases. You've always got actual racists on there. You've always got quacks who, you know, saying that vaccines give you autism and stuff like this. But it's so difficult to draw the line that on balance, you've got to say that the importance of allowing contrary viewpoints to be expressed, because they might be right and we may vastly improve ourselves by getting to the truth, is more important than shutting down a few quacks.
And the question for me as well, Tom, is where does this end? And I say this because I'm not sure that you can put this back in the box from whence it came. Once we decided as a human society that the truth of COVID was whatever the WHO said, and it was in the interest of protecting humanity that information or opinions, let's not say information, let's say opinions contrary to that, were to be deleted and hidden from the public. Well, what's the next step? I mean, look at climate change. Just before the lockdown happened, we had this whole big thing with Extinction Rebellion. Now, if you believe that climate change is a global threat to humanity, as many people do, and I'm willing to hear that view, then does that mean that any opinion contrary to that is a threat to human health and needs to be hidden and deleted? Right. What about racism? Is racism a threat to human health? Is police brutality? Do we need to remove opinions about that? Like, how far do you take this? And my worry is that this isn't going back in the box.
I think that's a perfectly bleak, but fittingly bleak place to end it. But Chris, Constantine, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.